RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Ags Energy and Resources spokesperson Simon Court is welcoming the coalition government's draft minerals strategy, which includes a whole lot of commitments made in the National Ag Coalition Agreement. He was in Blackball last week with Shane Jones for the announcement to update the Crown Minerals Act 91 to clarify its role as promoting the use of Crown minerals. So Simon Court joins us to tell us more about this. Welcome on. I think first time for you on RCR with me anyway. Simon, first time with me. How does it feel?
Hi, Paul. Well, always pleased to be speaking to an audience of people who know what's important for New Zealand. That's why I went to Blackball with Minister Jones. Yep. I have a role as Undersecretary for Resource Management Reform and Infrastructure Funding and Financing. And I also was insistent that in the coalition agreement between National and ACT, we promote the use of Crown minerals, and we get that in the agreement, and then we go ahead and change the law, because the previous government had decided that minerals, which includes oil and gas and yep. the things to get all out of the ground, things. Simply yep. weren't important anymore.
Why do you think? Because there's that classic announcement that everyone says is on the hoof, and Shane Jones is like going, what the hell, behind? So how did that happen? Because it's a no-brainer that we need this stuff, right?
Well, I wasn't in Parliament at that time, Paul. I was a civil engineer working on construction projects, primarily cleaning up old landfills and trying to stop them falling into the sea. But there's one thing that engineers and contractors know: you need diesel to run the gear so you can actually do the environmental work, so you can actually build things. I was shocked at the time in 2018. I have no insights into what Megan Woods and Jacinda Ardern and the others were thinking. I wonder if it was something that they dreamt up in the back of a taxi on the way to an event at Victoria University. I've been told it was, but I have no evidence of that. But it's the
kind that's
of
fast and loose, isn't it? That's fast and loose with such a thing.
There was no policy advice to support that decision, Paul. And, you know, we saw the effects of that, an immediate icing of investment intention for oil and gas exploration in New Zealand. We're now experiencing the results of that. This year, a gas shortage is forecast, and it's forecast to go on for maybe another 3 or 4 years, and can only be relieved if we bring investors back and we bring the drill rigs back and we actually get our own gas out of the ground. Otherwise, we're really in shock.
They must have known that was going to happen.
I think they must have known, and they didn't care. That's the impression I got, particularly when asking me Megan Woods questions directly in the House. They were totally obsessed with what they called their climate change policy. That's essentially stopping us doing things that they felt cause carbon emissions. They didn't have a plan except to announce things they were going to ban. And even when they announced the oil and gas ban, they actually didn't have a policy or a paper to support it. So even their own officials had no idea what they were meant to do next. Just a really bad example of how governments can wreck people's businesses and, you know, wreck entire countries' economies.
So what is this draft strategy? What does it mean? Where does the mining take place? What's accessible? What's not? Tell us.
Well, the mineral strategy gives effect to another one of the coalition commitments that I insisted go into the agreement around. We need a critical minerals list. So what the strategy says is there are some minerals, of course, gold, but there are others like vanadium, for example, and some of those other minerals used in making cell phones and satellites. Everything we use and consume now is based on electronics. We have a lot of those minerals here in New Zealand. They're not found very many places around the world, but our unique geology, particularly in the Southern Alps, means that they're at the surface here and we can get to them. Other places which have similar mineralogy include Russia and China and some parts of Central Africa. But what the mineral strategy says is, look, we've got the minerals here. We need to play our part in the global supply chain. We need to access resources that allow us to grow our economy. They provide for really high-paying jobs. They provide for, in the end, a restoration of the natural environment where these places operate. So in many ways, mineral mining activities are only temporary, much more temporary than building a house that's there forever. So, you know, what the mineral strategy says is we need to be able to identify where these minerals are and support businesses with the right regulations, providing an easy pathway for them to get consents from government, but also from regional councils, you know, RMA consents, Wildlife Act consents, conservation access. A lot of the land they need to cross to get to these deposits, even if they're on private land, is dockland. If you want to build a road on dockland, we need to make it easier to do that as well.
What are we missing out on at the moment? Can you put a value on it?
Look, that question came up last week in Blackball. You know, somebody asked, you know, I mean, how do you know if it's worth cutting down the trees and digging these holes? And you only have to look at the counterfactual. You know, if we don't access our own minerals here, then our national security is at risk because we're dependent on a global supply chain. We're 5 million people at the bottom of the world. You know, we can see what happens in other countries, you know, when their sea lanes are obstructed. So from a national security point of view, it's important. Also from a local economy point of view, I mean, the people I met working, say, at Federation Mine on the West Coast and others I've met involved in other mining projects down there, they earn really good money compared to the average Kiwi. They're earning well over $100,000. They typically have, you know, good lifestyles where they work a week on, week off. You know, they work 12-hour shifts.
How can I get that?
You know, but on their week off, you know, they've not only they got money to spend in their back pocket, but they also get a decent time off, particularly if they're working underground. So it's a good lifestyle. It's a good earner. If we're not promoting the use of our own resources here, these people will simply go to Australia or they'll go to South America. They'll go to places where their mining skills are going to be valued.
Right. The RMA, why does that come up short? I thought it was supposed to be a, you know, sort it all out and, you know, incredibly well thought out protection for the environment, but also trading off against the need, you know, to make money. Why is it a handbrake now?
Well, Paul, I think the people who came up with the Resource Management Act, they were looking backwards. They were looking back to a time when the New Zealand government, you know, power companies built dams and blocked rivers, flooded Lake Manapouri to build a power station. I mean, we knew at the time we needed the infrastructure, but the way they went about managing the environmental effects was pretty poor and got a lot of people upset. So the Resource Management Act provides for a lot of people to object to things, but it turns out we're letting far too many people object to far too many things. It's also turned out to be impossible to fulfill those UN Sustainable Development Goals that they came up with in 1991 in Rio de Janeiro. People were looking at the Amazon rainforest being cleared and said, geez, we've got to stop this. You know, how do we stop this happening in little old New Zealand as well? So they wrote all those kind of concepts around around sustainable development into our RMA. It's not possible to say, hey, we're going to build things, but every time we do something in the environment, we're going to apply precaution on precaution. I think what we've learned over the past 30 years, in fact, I'm confident what we've learned as an environmental engineer. I worked in the waste industry for nearly 15 years on building landfills, getting gas to energy systems up and running, and then closing and decommissioning and making safe old landfills, including some of those old council ones that were falling into the sea around Auckland, cleaning up hazardous waste. What we've learned is that we can build infrastructure, we can operate heavy industries in New Zealand, and we can manage those environmental effects in a way that's acceptable to communities. We don't need to go through a whole consenting process arguing about, you know, essentially the minute details of monitoring plans for fresh water, you know, ponds and so on. All of these conditions can simply be cut and paste from another site or another jurisdiction. I mean, every year in New Zealand, Kiwi spend about $1.3 billion just on consenting. And yet what wow. appears to be is we're literally having judges, courts, councils issue pretty much the same consent conditions each time for similar activities. but spending months or years arguing with applicants about those conditions.
Well, that's how you earn the money, Simon. You've got to keep it going, right?
You've actually hit on something there, Paul. If councils allow activities to happen as permitted activities around the RMA, they can't send you an invoice. But if they classify them as, you know, needing a consent, at that point, they can start charging for things. So we've really set up the system over many years to be quite perverse. Look, I've got a plan to change that. We're going to replace the Resource Management Act with a system based on this great concept called property rights. And what we propose to replace it with is a system where 80% of the things that you currently need consents for, you won't, because there'll be a basic national standard, a national code of practice for, say, doing some earthworks or building a retaining wall. You'll say to your local council, I'm following the national code of practice for earthworks or even for building a bridge or a culvert and a watercourse. You won't need consents for most of the things you do now. We'll be introducing that bill to the House, according to Prime Minister, Minister Luxon, who's expecting me to deliver it along with Minister Chris Bishop in the next 12 months. So, you know, we've got fast track before the House now.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Fast track. Okay. First of all, why is that needed? It's probably obvious in the naming of it. But also, we've got to be careful, don't we, that we don't get so enthusiastic that we kind of run away the other way and sort of everything's fast track. And, you know, we sort of end up doing the wrong thing the other way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're hearing those concerns come through loud and clear on Environment Committee. I also have a role sitting on that committee and hearing submissions. The Fast Track Approvals Bill is really meant to provide some urgent projects that need consents.
Give us an example, Simon. What sort of project are you talking about?
Well, what we do know, and Paul and your listeners, you'll be aware that there is no current list of projects. That has not been included in the bill.
But would it likely be oil or gas exploration or something in that line?
I think the intention is there's some major public infrastructure projects, potentially roads or wastewater treatment plants, which might take years and years and years to get consent through the normal process. Anyone who lives in Auckland, drives through Onehunga, knows how bad the traffic is there, how many heavy trucks are on the road. There's a project called East West Link, which has spent 5 years all the way to Supreme Court arguing about a birdhouse, essentially some rocks that are going to be piled up to provide for birds that live nearby, and whether the birds are going to be okay with that. I mean, that's the kind of project you'd say you put it into a fast track process and you get the wildlife people, the conservation people, you get the road builder, the road contractor and designer all in one room. They'd have it sorted out where the bird rocks should go, probably in about 2 weeks instead of 5 years and millions of dollars later. So it's projects like that that I would hope come up through the system through fast tracking, but there may well be other major projects, energy developments, manufacturing sites, potentially freight and distribution centres, which otherwise would spend years trying to get planning permission, trying to get consents and having to go, basically have every objector who turns up have the ability to take you all the way to the Supreme Court. This bill will fast track the approvals process, but will still allow for all the environmental consent conditions to be written into the approval. So I think it's the best of both worlds.
One of the things we've found out about in the last week or so is the Daisy Labs GMO dairy getting the nod via EPA fast track, only 10 days, I think. And if you look into it, it involves a secure lab. There are, in the risk assessment, some pretty terrible risks if anyone is exposed to and what's involved in the process and if it leaks out. And that was very quickly approved. And you've even got the general manager of EPA's Hazardous Substances and New Organisms, Dr. Chris Hill, describing a precision fermentation process as the potential to offer significant savings in land use, water use, and reduction in carbon footprint. And this new approval will allow them to scale up the work already underway and increase production. Well, he's the general manager. He sounds like he's promoting it. You see what I mean about this enthusiasm? We've got to be careful, don't we?
I think it's really important to acknowledge that where there are environmental risks, human health risks, you've got the right systems in place.
GMO, Simon, because we don't know the consequences of anything that could go wrong there, really. We can theorize, but we don't really know.
Well, and Paul, I think one of the reasons we don't know is because rather than following examples from other similar jurisdictions like the US, the EU, Japan, for example, New Zealand has stuck with the Helen Clark era, Nikki Hager, scary sweet corn concept of GMO that freaked Kiwis out, you know, back in the early 2000s when we didn't know that much about it. New Zealand is still, are concerned about GMO because we haven't been able to have the conversation about how it can be applied, particularly in medical health, as you say, in food tech, food science, and some of the other things we want to do with it. They have to be done safely. You know, we don't want to compromise our food production system. We don't want to compromise our international reputation as a clean, green country. But, you know, I'll give you an example. I went to the livestock, some livestock improvement business a couple of years ago, and I asked them, how long would it take you to breed a cow that has low methane but still tastes good? And they said, you know what, we could spend decades trying to breed the cow that has low methane and then breed the cow that tastes good, but trying to get both of those genes to turn up so it still tastes good and has low methane.
What if you don't care about the methane? Okay, I don't give a damn about the methane. All right? We're not all crazy on methane.
Paul, I only care
okay,
about...
Okay, so I don't want your methane altered cow, right? So what happens then?
Exactly. So I think the point is, if you wanted to test whether this would work, you could test it in the... You could theoretically test it inside of the laboratory and then in controlled conditions. You'd probably decide very quickly, Paul, it doesn't taste very good and you wouldn't waste any more time with it.
It tastes sort of methane-y.
Well,
it's all retained.
That's right. I mean, the methane that I most like, Paul, is the methane in natural gas that powers my barbecue.
Okay, so you've got no problem with
that. At home. Yeah. But some people are very concerned about cows and methane, Paul. I'm not one of them either.
Just getting back to Daisy Lab, not going to labour it, but here they're producing a genetically modified bacteria, which in nature would take a very long time,
that's right,
if ever, to get to that set of mutations this new bacteria. Mm. And that's part of the risk assessment, because if anyone gets that on board, it could kill them. So,
Paul, I haven't read the risk assessment, but I want to offer you and your listeners something else to think about. You know, a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago, a product known as golden rice was developed for use in developing countries where they have vitamin A deficiency. It's been widely tested. It's been grown and used. And just recently, Greenpeace took the Philippines government to court and has forced them to stop the release of this rice that has been genetically modified to include higher levels of vitamin A. Now, we get lots of vitamin A in our diet because Kiwis eat lots of dairy products and we have lots of meat in our diet. If you're a Filipino person in a poor part of the Philippines, you know, your diet is mostly rice with a bit of fish. And so, you know, there is a role for GMOs. They have been proven safe in some conditions. And I think it's just important that New Zealanders think about how we might use that technology, but also we do definitely want to protect our environment.
And have confidence in how it's being handled and managed.
Definitely.
Because there are certain things have happened over the last few years that we have no confidence in how it's managed. That's another story. Just quickly on that fast track legislation, what's the timeline progress on that? I should know, but I've got you in front of me. So,
well, Paul, it's currently before Select Committee. We've got a few more weeks of hearing from submitters on the bill. What's been really interesting is hearing from environmental NGOs and developers who both agree that actually we need a one-stop shop to consider environmental effects of major projects, where we actually get to look at the effects on land, on water, but also on conservation and wildlife. Currently, those things happen separately and they happen later after resource consents are issued. So, you know, we're getting some really good feedback. I think we're going to be able to recommend some positive changes to the bill out of Select Committee. It'll be up to the minister responsible for RM reform. That's Minister Bishop, if he wants to take those changes on board. I would imagine a report back to the House in the next couple of months and this bill will be passed in some form by the end of the year. And then only then can projects start applying for fast track.
So cranking the handle.
But Paul, yeah, the long game really is replacing the entire resource management system with one that is based on property rights. So because 99% of projects won't qualify for fast track. You know, most of the things you want to do on your farm or your local council replacing a culvert under a road.
Up to you, your land.
You know, you just want to be able to do that as a right, as long as you're following the right environmental code of practice. That's where we need to get to.
All right. Thanks for coming on and explaining all that, Simon Court, Axe Energy and Resources spokesperson. And hopefully we'll talk again. Thanks so much.
Looking forward to it, Paul. Thank you.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.